When I was a kid growing up in Jersey, anybody who was a hoot or really funny or something, we'd call them a riot. Ladies and gents, this guy's a riot in more ways than one. Bob Dylan.
It was gravity which pulled us in and destiny which broke us apart. You tamed the lion in my cage, but it just wasn't enough to change my heart. Now everything's a little upside down. As a matter of fact, the wheels have stopped. What's good is bad. What's bad is good. You'll find out when you reach the top. You're on the bottom. I noticed at the ceremony that you left all your bags behind. The driver came in after you left. He gave them all to me, and then he resigned. The priest wore black on the seventh day and waltzed around while the building burned. You didn't trust me for a minute, babe. I've never known the spring to turn so quickly into autumn. Idiot wind, blowing every time you move your jaw, from the Grand Coulee Dam to the Mardi Gras. Idiot wind, blowing every time you move your teeth. You're an idiot, babe. It's a wonder that you still know how to breathe. This is Pod Dylan, the show that celebrates the work of Bob Dylan one song at a time, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, the freewheeling Rob Kelly, and this is kind of a different episode. We're not talking about one song. We're talking about a whole bunch of songs, namely the bootleg series release, More Blood, More Tracks, with which just hit the streets a couple of weeks ago. And I can't think of a better guest to have on than my old pal, Pat Butler. Hi, Pat. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Always great to be here. Hope I sound good. What can we say, man? It's been a long time.
It's been a while. We haven't been on since episode 60, which was when we talked about maybe someday. This is a bit of an uptick in terms of the renowned quality of Bob Dylan's career. Yeah, I mean this box set. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'd say for a lot of Dylan fans, this was the set they were waiting for. This one.
Yes.
I'm kind of amazed it took this long to get to it, really. But who knows for the reasons why they released all this other. I mean, they got the self-portrait before they got to Blood on the Tracks. But I mean, this is the set. This is the presumably the complete Blood on the Track sessions, in that it is every single thing recorded.
Yep.
Related to Blood on the Tracks. And we have, of course, lots of thoughts on this set. But, Pat, let's just start off, like, what is your overall impression of this set? Just, like, the quick review, what did you think of it as in total?
So, okay. I think as a completist, as someone who wants every note Bob Dylan ever made, this is by far the best thing they've ever done, because they didn't monkey around with it. They literally gave you every single take in the studio. I mean, you and I have talked about this, but these New York sessions are legendary, right?
Right.
We've wanted to hear this stuff forever. I've heard about how the band actually was so much better and the New York versions are better and all this. So I am so glad that I finally have every single take, you know, but I have a good tie here, Rob. So listen, you know, a lot of that for hours and hours, right? And I am so happy that they just recognized what the fans really wanted was to have this, you know, I wanted to hear every version of this. I like the fact that we get to hear all the little mistakes, the buttons clicking on the guitar. I've wanted to hear this for years, and I think they really were smart to recognize that in the fan community and at large, this is one of the greatest albums of all time, and you got to give people the chance to see an artist develop himself over the course of a few days and really turn these songs into the masterpieces that they always were, but, you know, stepping them up a notch. So I'm blown away that we got everything, because, you know, this is the same week the Beatles are releasing the White Album again, you know, and even then you're not getting everything, you know what I mean?
Right,
like you're getting a lot of stuff, but you're not getting everything. And I really appreciate that the Dylan camp kind of recognized, like, people want everything. So I think it's awesome. But then you also realize, do you really need everything? You know,
do I need the 37 second false start of Tangled Up in Blue?
Right. Exactly. You know, I like the fact that it's there, because I can complete my collection. I really do. I mean, I'm just like, so you and I both think this is the greatest thing Bob Dylan ever did, right?
So I agree. This is my favorite album of his.
Is, this is my favorite album of all time.
That I too, mean, right. It's not only my favorite Dylan album, it's my favorite album, period.
So, you know, it's like if I was going to classical music shows or something, you know, I want to hear the scores from whatever. So this is that for me. So I really appreciate it. But I have to say that even as a musician and everything, I can't even tell, you know, take 13 from take 14 for some of these songs. I get a little lost. There's little variations that if you're really tuned in, you can kind of pick up. But, you know, I don't know that you need everything if you're not a hardcore completist like we are. But I think other than that, I mean, what can you say? It's awesome. I mean, this is just extraordinary. And I have to say, I have heard for years that the band stuff wasn't that good. I mean, the whole reason that he scrapped all the band tracks except for Meet Me in the Morning was that they didn't come out that good. Well, that's clearly not true.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Some of this stuff was really pretty good. I mean, it would have sounded a little too much Planet Waves, so I think that was a good move on his part. And it also shows the genius of Bob is that he recognized where he nailed it and where he didn't and what he wanted. He knew what he wanted to do when he went into the studio. So I love it. I think it's great. I'm super happy that we have it, and you know. But I think you can have nitpicks like anything. But I, overall, I would say it's an A+ for me. I don't know. What do you think?
Fair enough. Well, with these bootleg series, when they're focused like this around an album, you know what I mean. Like there were other ones that have been more longer spanning. But when there's a set like this that it's around a certain album, like the self-portrait ones or the ones that are just focused on Highway 61. I always feel it's a dicey proposition because I want there to be good stuff on there, but I don't want there to be too good stuff on there because then it's going to color my view of the album. I mean, when I was first getting into Bob, I regarded Infidels as one of his greatest works.
Wow.
And then after I heard all the stuff that he left off of Infidels, I can't ever listen to Infidels again and not think, there's a much better version of Infidels out there, and he really kicked this album in the teeth for kind of no good reason. I didn't want that to happen on Blood on the Tracks. I didn't want there to be stuff. I mean, we talked about on the previous episode I did with John Glenn just a couple episodes ago about Up to Me, that I think Up to Me belongs on Blood on the Tracks, full stop. But I also kind of like, I bought Biograph not too long after I bought Blood on the Tracks. I was getting into Bob all at that same time, and so I kind of grew, you know, putting air quotes, grew up with it all together at the same time. So I sort of accepted that, all right, there's this one song that didn't make it on, but the album is still a masterpiece. But I was like, I don't gonna say scared, but I didn't want this box set to reveal to me that Blood on the Tracks could have been even better, because I just I don't know what was going to tolerate that. But luckily, I don't think this set does that. There is a lot of brilliant stuff here, and there's particularly one thing that I will get to in a moment that I think makes it all worth it. But there isn't anything here that I go, oh, this is so clearly superior to what he put on the album that the album is now a flawed masterpiece. No, to me, Blood on the Tracks remains intact. I ultimately feel that all of the choices that he made were the correct choices, and so I'm kind of happy about that. It makes the set probably a little less dramatic, that there isn't some amazing treasure trove of, I mean, it's interesting to know finally, conclusively, that those 7 or 8 lost songs that are in the notebook were apparently never recorded. Those do not exist anywhere.
Right.
And while some part of me is a little disappointed that I'll never get to hear those, if they don't exist, they don't exist. I mean, what can you do? But I listen to this set and I go, wow, this is fascinating. It's interesting to hear him build these songs. And I mean, good Lord, I love that they even included some of the audio, just the Bob talking. I mean, I've listened to, I mean, how many thousands of hours has this man been in a recording studio? And I think I can probably, if you added up all the times I've heard him literally talking in a studio, it'd probably
like
probably
10 minutes.
Yeah, maybe 10 minutes, you know. Yeah. But I mean, when he finishes that one version of Buckets of Rain and you hear him go, I can do better. Like, whoa, okay. And then the other time where he does Meet Me in the Morning and he literally says, yeah, we're not going to use that. File it away. It's just like, it's fascinating just to hear him talking, presumably to Ellen Bernstein or whoever he's talking to on the other side of the glass.
The best is still, put the slide guitar on him and Mick Jagger having like debate about which one is it, Meet Me in the Morning? I forget, but he's like, put the slide guitar in it or whatever. And it's like, is that Mick Jagger? Like, he's having like Mick Jagger just showed up at these sessions. That's all new to me, by the way. I had no idea that Jagger was walking around.
That's funny that you mention that, because in Clinton Halen's book, the recording sessions, he talks about Mick Jagger showing up and that Dylan did a cover of Little Red Rooster as kind of a tribute to Mick, which is not on this set. So I don't know whether either Clinton Halen got that wrong, or that didn't really happen, or it just didn't get recorded. Maybe he did it, but they didn't record it. I could see why they wouldn't necessarily record it. I will say I was surprised to hear Spanish is the Loving Tongue thrown in. Like, I was like, what? Where did this come from? That's a song that, it's funny, I have, I think, four versions of that by Bob, and it's like, it's a song that he either does beautifully or horribly. There's no middle ground. That version on the Dylan record is garbage, and yet
garbage. The self-portrait,
but yet the B-side that was included on the B-side for Watching the River Flow and is a bootleg is beautiful. So it's and I like this version too. So it's like Bob either just chucks it all away or actually tries on some. But that was a surprise to hear that like, wow, I didn't know that. Why was that even here? Why did he even do it?
I guess overall I agree with you. I this did not change my view of the album at all. And I just want to say I think Up to Me is a masterpiece.
Yep.
I listened to it this morning as I was driving out to, I was talking to you earlier about what I was doing this morning, but I was like, this song is so good. I mean, this is the best Kris Kristofferson song. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, this is his, and this is a throwaway for him, which always just, again, makes me just in awe of this man. I don't know that I've ever actually would want this on the album, because I feel that Blood on the Tracks, again, is such a perfect album. I think it's the right amount of tracks. I think it's the right mix of band and solo acoustic. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think all the lyrics match. I've always had a big debate with my friends about Lily Rosemary, because a lot of people feel that song is weirdly out of place on this album. I don't think it is. I think it's the refresher in the middle of the record, and it's interesting to actually hear that song without the band in the New York sessions, because I actually don't think it works. I mean, it's interesting to listen to, but it feels like it's kind of, I don't know. For me, the Minnesota sessions were the best thing that ever happened on this album. And I it's great to, I agree with you. It's great to hear what he kind of had in mind, but it's so good that he went and he ran into his brother and they were like, let's put a band on this. And, because there's nothing in this box set that makes me go, oh, that's really like the lost jam. That's better than anything on the record.
Right, right. At the same time, I regard these box sets as kind of like, is there one thing, just one song, is there one song out of this whole set that I immediately say, oh my God, this is one of the best things I've heard him do, and it helps me recontextualize certain things. And I had that with like the self-portrait set, when there's that song in there called Tattle O'Day, which it hit me like a 2x4, and I'm like, this is one of the greatest things I've ever heard him do, this little simple little cover of this nonsense song. And yet I have listened to Tattle O'Day probably 500 times since I bought that set. I mean, I've wanted to do an episode on of Pod Dylan about it, but like, nobody's gonna ever pick that as a list of of songs to talk about Tattle O'Day.
Hey, Rob, you and I.
We'll there we go. Okay, I'll write that down. Pat Butler, Tattle O'Day.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that.
But for this set, when it first came out, I bought it on iTunes, by the way. I don't own the physical set. I actually have been buying it off of iTunes because I have limited space and whatever.
Of course.
But so I started just sort of cherry picking initially, because it was Friday morning and I was like, well, look, I don't have time to listen to everything. I'm just going to like super cherry pick some stuff and listen to it now. And one of the first things I picked was You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go, track five, take five. And that song, as recorded on the album, this jaunty little song, and in the middle of this, the kind of the happiest song you would get on the record, which is, that's always been one of my favorite Dylan tunes of all time. Mm-hmm. It's probably my second favorite song on the whole record. I just thought it was such a beautiful song of heartbreak, but yet kind of this resigned, it's okay, I'll deal with it, it's fine. Because, of course, he's talking to somebody else. He's not talking to the main person of the record. He's talking to this other person. You're going to make me lonesome when you go. And it's got such delightful rhyme schemes with the I'll look for you in Honolulu, San Francisco, or Ashtabula. It's so beautiful. And I never considered that song could be done any other way than the way it was done on the record. And yet, here's this take five version, this slow, drawn out version, which is almost kind of epic. And I have listened to that, no kidding, multiple times a day, every day since I got it. It has almost brought me to tears. That version is so beautiful. And while I'm glad he went with the one that he went with, this version, I'm like, okay, I now think of this song in a completely different way. And it's one of the reasons I keep kind of like, this guy never disappoints me. You know, like I keep coming back to him. I've been an obsessive fan now for 25 years, and it never fades, because he keeps finding ways for me to go, oh my God, how did he do that? How did he hear the song? You're gonna make me lonesome when you go, and hear it in those two completely different ways, and they both work on their own terms. It's just constantly stunning, and let alone the other version, which is that kind of like countrified thing that he does with the band. It's like I just don't know how he can hear this sort of this bass metal and figure out a way to just keep moving the pieces around and have it all work in its own different. It's just completely stunning to me. So to me, the whole set is worth it just for that take five of "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go."
Well, I have to say, I agree with you. I think that's the best thing. That's the standout for me, right? Particularly the band version, the take five, because I like the organ. And the way it kind of like comes in, and it's a little bit 70s, but I told you Band in Love is one of my favorites of his, you know, it's just like it all melts together in a way. And I think you're right. I think there's something every time I listen to this set, and I have to admit, there's 87 tracks here.
Right. There's only so many. So, we wanted to get this episode out relatively quickly, but at the same time, I haven't had a lot of time to listen to every version a thousand times.
Already. Yeah. So 3A, you know, I maybe didn't give as much attention to that. But I do think it's really cool to watch him kind of like do things a little bit differently, change words around. I would say that for the most part, the lyrics seem to be consistent, you know, from the time he started them from take one to what was released in the 70s. It all seems pretty consistent. The only difference is, again, like you said, like the band versions are a little bit different, but you're right. They do recontextualize the songs. I mean, "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome" for me was, like you said, it's almost like this aside song to this girlfriend, like, I'm in love with you, but I can't really be with you because I'm in this hardcore relationship with this other woman. And then you hear the band version. It's really it's beautiful, really. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like a traveling song. I don't know. It makes you want to grab your bags and go, right? You're gonna make me lonesome because I'm leaving though, because I'm coming to be with you. Like it does. There's a lot of stuff like that. "Idiot Wind." I think it's take three or something like that. The version on the album is so angry, and I love it. I mean, how many times have I screamed those words out?
Beautiful, beautiful, righteous anger in that song.
But then you listen to the versions from New York. It's a really different song, isn't it? I mean, it feels almost like he's mad at himself in a way that he's right. I don't know. His vocal is different. It's a really different song in New York. And I'm also kind of disappointed. I mean, they said, look, this is what it is. They don't have anything from Minnesota, right? I mean, they're like, whatever got released is what they have from the Minnesota tapes. And maybe you might want to explain a little bit about what we're talking about, but between New York and Minnesota. But I don't know. The New York versions of some of the songs are so different. And then the Minnesota versions of some of the songs are so different, but yet it's so good. Right. I don't know. I'm blown away. It's incredible.
I am kind of amazed that there isn't more leftover stuff from the Minnesota. So, and again, for anybody, I don't know anybody who possibly listens to the show that doesn't know this, but let's just go over very quickly is that, you know, Dylan recorded all of this material in New York with Ellen Bernstein, who was a Columbia Records executive, who supposedly is the subject of "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go," but it doesn't matter. And then the album was finished and finished, scheduled.
It was pressed.
Was it pressed? Okay.
Yeah. Listen, Rob, and you and I are both Northeast guys, you know, so there's vinyl record stores around Boston, Philadelphia, New York, etc. If you go, you'll see Blood on the Tracks with like a sticker for like $400. it's the original New York pressing.
Oh Lord! Oh wow! Yeah. Okay. I didn't know that it was. I didn't know that it was pressed, but I knew that it was basically a finished record. And in fact, the liner, the on the back cover, there's the album sleeve notes by the author Pete Hamill, and he quotes lyrics that aren't on the record because this record was changed so quickly. So anyway, Dylan brings the record with him back to his home in Minnesota, presumably going home for Christmas or, I guess, Hanukkah, really. And his brother David, apparently, which in a kind of an amazing bit of effrontery, really, told his brother, you know what, I think you can do better, which is like, whoa. those two must be close. And then Dylan decided to recut most of the album or a good chunk of it with local Minnesota musicians, and that ended up... it meant the album was pulled. It was supposed to come out in December of 75, and it got pulled, or December of 74, I think, and it got pulled and had to get pushed into January of the following year. And again, the liner notes are a little different, and it had all these different versions. And I think anyone can listen to the New York version and say this, if that had been the album, the Blood on the Tracks had been just comprised of the New York cuts, it'd be a much different record and arguably less commercial, because it's all the songs are a lot slower. They're a lot more downbeat. It is interesting to me that there is no alternate version that we have, I guess, that exists of the version we hear on the record of Tangled Up in Blue. There is all the versions on this set are the New York takes, which are the slower versions with the different lyrics. And I know people, there are a lot of people who say that the New York version, they prefer that one. Everybody, you know, your mileage may vary. To me, the Minnesota take of Tangled Up in Blue, the one that's on the album,
that's the keeper,
is one of the single greatest things the man has ever recorded. I would literally put it in the top three greatest songs he's ever recorded. I would put it in one of the greatest pop recordings of all time. And so to me, I'm like, these other New York versions, they're interesting. They work on their own terms, but there is nothing that touches that album version. And yes, you could say that that album version is more commercial because it's faster, it's more upbeat. But he captures an energy to me in that version. And I would have loved to have heard slight alternates of that, but I guess they don't exist. They're not anywhere, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Tangled Up in Blue is, to me, it's one of the greatest pieces of art ever made.
Yes.
I'm sorry, art. My Boston accent. But it is today, it's yesterday, it's tomorrow. He really truly... He said, you know, he learned about painting and then he tried to write a song that was like painting. And I don't know anyone who doesn't disagree with that, you know, that's like, yes, that's exactly what it's like. That's what life is like, you know? And I agree with you because I feel like as an opener on the officially released version from 1974, 75 there, it really reset his career, but it's also just, it's so good. I mean, it's just the perfect opener and the way the chords come out and stuff. The New York versions, I don't dislike them or anything like that, but I think I don't know if I would like them without knowing the band version from Minnesota. You know what I mean? I'm not like this with any other record. You know what I mean? Like I like the keys over here. You know, to me, it's like, this is just perfect. A couple years ago, they put out the stuff with Blonde on Blonde and bringing it all back home. And that was all really cool to hear. And there were actually some songs that I was like, hey, that would have been cool. They could have put that out, you know? I find with this, particularly, like you said, the Minnesota versions I would like to hear more of in a way, but we don't have it. And I think maybe in a way that might be the best thing because this is it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like the myth will forever live that he went into Minnesota, the recording studio with David Zimmerman, who never got a credit for anything in his life.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks, bro. You saved my career. But I mean, come on. He was so right. How spot on that guy was to recognize that, you know, mix it up a little bit. Because the brilliance of this album, if you listen to it the way it was sequenced and everything, is that you have, you know, a band song and then you have this beautiful acoustic song that has the melancholy and the longing and then the band song. You know, it was so perfectly done. And then when you listen to the New York version, I'm like, they thought they were going to put this out like that? I mean, I really am a little surprised. Yeah, I'm just curious to how he thought that you know, was going to really fly. You're Going to Make Me Lonesome might have worked, both versions, you know. But I like the way it came out at the end, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I Tangled Up in Blue, from my life experience, has been to me the one song that even people who don't like Bob Dylan like that song.
Love, yeah.
There are people I know. I have met people who are like, nah, I don't really like him, but they're like, but I'm like, oh, Tangled Up in Blue is him. And they're like, oh, I like that one. I think that that's something people capture. One of the other things that I thought about when listening to the set was there are all great versions of these songs, and you could make a genuine alternate Blood on the Tracks record with these outtakes, and you would not have like a subpar album. This is the only album I can think of where there are perfectly workable, more than workable, that's a left-handed compliment. There are perfectly good, in fact very good, alternates of every song on the record, and you could compile I don't think there's any other Dylan album that you can say that there are that many versions of every song that you could do that for. I mean, you're right, I love the album version of You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome, but man, if he had used the band one, I would have been like, okay, this is just terrific. Idiot Wind, again, it's another one of those ones where I like the New York lyrics more than the Finnish lyrics, but I like the album performance more than the performance of the New York thing. So if there had been a version with the alternate lyrics but the album performance, that would have been the perfect, because the stuff I quoted at the top of the show, the thing about from the Grand Coulee Dam to the Mardi Gras, like I just love that turn of phrase, and I wish that had made it to the original, the final version. But again, the pace, I think if you had had all the New York songs together, it just would have been a lot of slow stuff. And, you know, but this, with the final album, you've got the sort of the exuberant, the push of Tangled Up in Blue, and then he slows it way down with Simple Twist of Fate. That's a song that I like the alternate versions that we hear, but he is, I think the style of singing on the alternate Simple Twists of Fate are, he's trying a little harder, like he's trying to kind of like get more into the words and get more out of them, I mean, and I actually like the album version because the album version sounds so sad that the singer has barely any energy even to get the words out, which I really like because that song is so desolate. I really like how that so again, that's another version where I like the alternates, but the album one was ultimately the one to go.
Yeah, you nailed it. You nailed it for there. It's desolate to me when he's on the album version when he sings, she, you know, I was born too late. There's so much sadness, and the sparseness of the arrangement with the acoustic guitars and the bass gives it that, you know, he woke up, the room was bare. The song is bare.
Yeah.
You know, the band version is it's cool. It's interesting. I mean, let's not forget, this was a great band. I mean, these guys were all top notch musicians, you know? But I agree with you. I just felt like I was like, oh, it almost sounds like third rate Planet Waves before, you know what I mean? Like it doesn't hit me the same way. And then when I hear Twist of Fate done, just him and the bass player, I mean, that's why it was a keeper. And the other one I want to point out was You're a Big Girl Now, the New York version. I feel like that's a very different song in New York. I feel like the Minnesota version, to me, the sadness in the Minnesota version is there. And in New York, it's more melancholy, I guess, you know, because I know he's doing different chords and everything like that. But there's something about the vocal of like, ah, in Minnesota, you know, it's a pain that stops and starts, you know, in Minnesota, that really comes through. The New York version, it's more like, ah, you know, he's in pain, but it's like, I might get through this. You know, it's weird. So it's weird how some of these songs are more painful in Minnesota, and some of them are more painful in New York. And, you know, and here's the other thing, Rob. I was thinking, you know, he always says, oh, no, these were just Chekhov stories. I don't know why everyone thinks this is about
me. Yeah, this isn't right. Yeah.
Well, now that we have the red notebook in this thing, and basically all the words are there, he wrote these songs. He knew exactly what he wanted to say.
Yeah.
I mean, he knew exactly what he was doing. He was just messing around with guitar chords and arrangements and stuff, but he knew 100% this was what he was trying to say to his soon-to-be ex-wife. I mean, there's just no question, right? Now, for me, I really truly feel like there's always been a little bit of like, oh, no, it's really not about that. No, this is about that. And he'll never be able to say that again, you know, because now we have the red notebook. Now we have these arrangements. And we can see that from take one through Minnesota, pretty much everything was the same word, you know, lyric wise, except for music, you know, and that's the only thing he was messing with.
I do wonder, just to move off the songs for a second, I do wonder, like, how they have convinced the notoriously private Bob Dylan to kind of reveal that stuff about himself, like that he would he would allow his notebook to be released and like published for people to consume. That's sort of interesting to me. I mean, I remember reading, I remember reading an article about him a bunch of years ago, right during, I think during Time Out of Mind, where he sort of like, there was a lot of front page articles written about him, and Newsweek interviewed him because he was sort of, you know, like Dylan's back, quote unquote.
Right. Well, he almost died, yeah.
Yeah, right, after the histoplasmosis thing. And they were talking about how they said even there are close friends of his that don't know what he does when he gets up in the morning. Like, he leads a sort of mysterious life. I mean, and so I'm kind of fascinated that this is all the stuff that he considered so private, and now it's okay. If you want to be really cynical, you could say, well, right, there's a market there for it, and he's willing to sort of sell these pieces of his past for money. You could, I mean, obviously he's making some money off of this, but at the same time, and maybe he's got enough distance from it, because, I mean, good Lord, Blood on the Tracks is 40 years ago at this point. Maybe he feels okay that, you know, that back when I was close to it, I couldn't do it, but now I can, right, and now it's okay.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it again, it was interesting about track one of side two with the Call Letter Blues, Meet Me in the Morning thing. Then he kind of kept persevering with the alternate version, the Call Letter Blues. And I would say, I think I kind of like the Call Letter Blues more than Meet Me in the Morning. But that might just be because the Call Letter Blues is the alternate, and you tend to kind of like the novelty one more than the one that you know.
Right.
The whole line about the children cry for mother, I tell them mother took a trip, and yeah, then the bar girls in the doorway are giving me the eye, my heart's just not in it, I might as well pass right on by. I love those lines so much that I kind of miss them, not in Meet Me in the Morning. But nevertheless, they're both still really great songs. But it was fascinating how many takes there were of that.
Right?
I would have thought maybe that was something he'd done once or twice, and then he kind of nailed it. But no, he kind of kept working at it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you 100%. I've always felt that Meet Me in the Morning is actually a perfect take, but I agree with you. The Call Letter Blues lyrics are so much more painful. I mean, that thing about the children crying, I mean,
yeah,
how do you not get moved by that,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
The only thing I can speculate is that maybe you're right. There's a bit of distance. And I also think that maybe because now that so much of this stuff is not really his anymore, you know, he's given it over to that archive and everything. And I'm sure
that's
there's,
true, yeah,
you know, there's all kinds of like, hey, we're, you know, I mean, look, you and I have talked about this a lot, but I mean, the guy's in his late 70s now. I mean, like, you know, he's got to have on some level thinking to himself, like, I mean, I want people to study this stuff, you know? So I think that there's more and more of a, okay, people really consider this important. It is important. I mean, think of how many, you're an artist, you know, I mean, how inspirational is this record? I mean, almost everybody I know who likes Dylan or loves Dylan, and this is their thing. I mean, there's really nobody, you know, I mean, I guess if you were part of that first wave of folkies in the 60s or whatever, but like, this is the record, right? And so, yeah, to have this is so big because you see an artist processing. You know, you watch how an artist actually builds a song, you know, change that lyric, move it to this key, you know,
mm-hmm,
you know, like I said, like we were just talking, like Call It a Blues. I mean, that's a painful blues song and ends up being Meet Me in the Morning, ultimately, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, he clearly didn't want to reveal that much. He didn't want to talk about the children crying. I mean, he's very private about the kids. He's never, right? I mean, we all know that.
Like, yep, yep.
I mean, when Jacob Dylan came out in the 90s, and I'm a 90s kid, you know, I was like, what? Okay. I mean, it was like, whoa, Bob Dylan's got kids, you know?
Right, so, and there was that whole daughter that was revealed like about 15
right,
years ago that nobody knew about.
Yeah. So he's good
at that, yeah.
Yeah, so I think on some level maybe that's what it was. He was kind of sitting there going, you know what? I know that's really good, and I know that that's a take, but it says too much about me. So, you know, I'm gonna go with this other version I did, which, by the way, Beat Me in the Morning can be both a very carnal song and a very, you know, regretful song. I mean, there's so mm-hmm. much. And again, I think that's the other thing that underlies Blood on the Tracks overall is this sense of time is kind of shifting, you know, because relationships shift. You're in love, you hate, you love, you know, there's, but it's all kind of a cycle. And that's why it'll always be his greatest work, in my view, because, it's the one time he kind of nailed it and consistently. I mean, I love Bob Dylan. You and I both love Bob Dylan. We have everything. But to watch these tracks, to listen to this bootleg series, I mean, you really get that he kind of knew it on this one record. He had it there from day one. And that's, to me, the most surprising thing, because the cutting edge kind of showed me he was always messing around with it, you know, and he was changing lyrics and writing new lyrics all the time and stuff. He wasn't doing that on this record. He had a very specific vision of what he wanted to say, and the only thing he wanted to change maybe was the music. And, you know, I think it's extraordinary, but I think that the finished product is the best thing. It's the best representation of what he was trying to say at that time.
Yeah, there are quotes from Ellen Bernstein who says that at the time, I mean, other than Idiot Wind, which was probably the song tinkered with the most in terms of the words,
yeah.
But they said, you know, the words are mostly there from the beginning, and also the sequencing. Like there's a quote from her saying that there was never much of a discussion about what order to put these songs in. They just sort of fell into place, and once everybody saw that was like, okay, that's the order. And there just was not a lot of, well, we could move here, and you really can't imagine the album any other way. Going back to the song specifically, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, there again, that's that I like the slower version. I like that one missing verse. I love that idea that Dylan was like, oh, these words are perfect except for that one verse that's coming out. And I always figured that one verse is out because that's the only verse in the whole song that is from the Jack of Hearts' point of view. And maybe he figured it was better to have the Jack of Hearts be this mysterious figure who you never learn anything about. You know, you never get inside the head of the Jack of Hearts. He's just this figure that comes in and sort of, forget my language, like fucks with everybody else in the story and then rides out of town. It's that one verse, though, where we sort of hear things from his point of view. So I could see him saying, no, that's coming out. I like the slow version, but again, I think the album version is superior, again, because it's such a long song, and yet it just moves at such a great pace. It's such a jaunty, I keep using this phrase, jaunty. I'm trying to imagine what it must be like to be a musician and playing a song with Bob Dylan that's 8 minutes long, and you just must be just sitting there praying to yourself, please don't screw up, please don't screw up. Because once you're into minute seven of a great take, are you just sitting there going, oh, God, please don't let me be the one that hits a bum note because this thing is going so well. I can't imagine the pressure. Or maybe you just get in the zone and you don't get in your own head like that. I don't know.
I mean, my guitar is tuned in E, as all the musicians out there listening will know, so I can't play it. But I think that's what happens. I mean, that's a song that, like, once you get the basic chords down, you got it, you know? And it's a very simple song in that sense. And then you just flow with it. And the jauntiness, I think, that's why the band version is so important in a way, because again, it breaks the record up, right? Because people always say to me, they're like, what is that song doing on this record? I'm like, I think that song is actually subtextually a lot about the relationship. You know what I mean? Because Bob could be the Jack of Hearts, or he could be Lily, you know, he could be vice versa.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, I've always said this. I mean, Bob Dylan is in love with American mythology, you know, particularly Western and Southern mythology. So that's a song about bank robberies and everything. And it breaks your mind away from all this heartbreak going on in this record. I mean, the song before it, you know, is like the most heartbreaking song in the world. So to have that kind of open up the second side or the second, it just really moves you. And I think that for a musician, at least, once you're in that groove, you know, you're just in it. And then that's the thing. He's the poet, you know, he's kind of singing the song over that. And yeah, I mean, I suppose now I think, Rob, people would be more intimidated. You know, like, that's Bob Dylan. I don't want to screw up. But
it could be. Yeah.
I think these guys in Minnesota in 1974 or whatever were probably just like, oh, it's David's brother. I mean, I think they knew who he was.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But I think that they also were clearly they're really good, because actually, if you read about what happened to them afterwards, a lot of them ended up working in L.A. I mean, these guys were good, you know. So they called it right. I mean, they just called it right. I don't know. It's so good.
we should talk about that too. In that there was I hate to use the word controversy because that just gets that gets overused.
I agree.
Like, the word outrage is outrage. You know, we see that. See that every time I log into my Comcast account, it's like outrage over Kate Middleton's dress. It's like, is that really outrage? Is that really the right term for this? But there was some controversies that for many years the Minnesota musicians were not credited on this record. And I don't know whose fault that is. I don't think that's necessarily Dylan's, although, of course, he probably could have fixed it if he really focused on
Push for it, yeah.
But these were guys that were on, you know, the performing musicians on one of the greatest records ever recorded, and yet they were not given proper credit. And so luckily this box set finally fixes that. And I'm going to go over the names of these guys. First, there's Tony Brown, who was the guy in the New York sessions from the band Deliverance. He was the one playing bass on a lot of these songs. But these other guys, Chris Weber, Kevin Odegaard, Peter Ostrusko, Greg Inhofer, Billy Peterson, and Bill Berg. I mean, these guys didn't know Bob Dylan at all. I mean, they knew who he was, but they didn't know him. And here he comes, and we're like, hey, man, we're going to recut half this album. And they just, I mean, you listen to the final performance, it's like these guys were on fire. And it was a crime that they had to go so long uncredited because, I mean, not only did that deny them a certain amount of literal financial remuneration, but also just the credit, just to be able to. I mean, I would think that if you're a musician and you walk – now, obviously, if you're in the world of recording, people know stuff that the public doesn't know. But nevertheless, I would think if you were a musician, you sure as hell would want your name on blood on the tracks. My God.
Well, when they're making it, though, did they know that? I mean, you know.
Well, right,
I mean,
but I'm saying afterwards, though, you would think that you would get the record and go, "Where the hell's my name? I'm the guy playing mandolin on, you know, whatever on three tracks Tangled on this song. Where am I? You know."
I actually think that's Bob playing mandolin. I think Bob plays mandolin on Tangled Up in Blue in Minnesota. But I know what you're saying, and I also think. I think eventually Kevin Odegaard or whatever made a book about it, you know, which isn't a bad book, actually. It's called, I think it's called Blood on the Track, the recording of Blood on the Track.
Okay, I've never read that, no, okay.
Yeah, I found it on Kindle because, you know, everything's on, you know, the internet these days. But eventually, people knew about them down the road.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, they clearly had some sense of, like, this is really good.
Yeah.
But they had, who knew that it was going to be a number one record? And... be the, you know, one of the 25 greatest albums made in the, you know, who knew that?
It would definitively prove to a lot of people that Bob Dylan was not just a 60s act anymore. He was an ongoing creative artist who could release work as good as his 60s heyday, and he would go and he would not be, and I don't want to compare him to other musicians because I don't like dissing other musicians to praise Bob, but we all know there are a lot of musicians from the 60s that were Bob's peers who have never matched their output of the 60s later on. It doesn't mean that they didn't produce great work, but they had it in the 60s and they never kind of had it again. Dylan escaped that with, but I mean, a lot of people, you look at New Morning and Planet Waves and Knocking on Heaven's Door, and there's a lot of great stuff there, but it's Blood on the Tracks that really was like, no, you critics that wrote me off, you don't know what you're talking about, because this, you know, here is the record. Going back to the songs, If You See Her, Say Hello. Again, I actually like a lot of the alternate ones. Some of the alternate ones on this set could have been subbed in on the record. I would have been fine with. That's kind of, I think it's probably my least favorite song on the record. That's still not saying, I still love them all. I mean, it's, you know, it's like the worst pizza you ever had. It's still pretty good. but nevertheless, like that's another song that he vocally was clearly trying to find the right tone for. I think he had the tune down, but vocally he didn't know where he wanted to go with it. I mean, where are you on that? Was there a version you liked more than the album one?
No, actually the album one, I mean, I don't, you know, I know we don't try to get too personal, but the album version of If You See Her, Say Hello was like, that was actually my favorite song for many years because I was really into like a certain girl and she wasn't into me. And I always thought that was like again, it's the perfect distillation of like when you love or you're into someone, you know, and they don't like you and you're like, well, actually, I hope they're better. And I think that in these outtakes, I mean, I guess in the New York versions, If You See Her always felt, again, there's a dissonance, right? Because it almost feels like it's kind of like not really like, it's either more melancholy or it's like more angry. I don't know. The way he does it is a little weird. I'm trying to think of the take that I liked about it. But and so for me, the only song I think I might have changed maybe would be Meet Me in the Morning for Up to Me or something like that. But
okay.
But or Call It a Blues. Actually, Call It a Blues would be the better substitute for Meet Me in the Morning. And again, I think you're going to make me lonesome. there's something about the fact that it comes in the middle of the record and you've gone through a whole bunch of emotional stuff at the beginning of the album, and then that comes in. It's this little sprightly acoustic guitar number on the official release. To hear this band version, I don't know. I think you and I have talked about it a little bit today. It's like that's such a gem, right? I mean, I don't know if I want that on the album, but I'm really glad it's out there now, you know, because I feel like maybe that's the way I would do it if I was doing a show or something, you know what I mean, mm-hmm, today. Mm-hmm. It just feels like there's something about that I respond to. I like the keyboards. I really love that because it's melancholy, but I feel like he's kind of telling her, like, I'm going to pack my bags today, you know, without telling her that, you know, because the lyrics are all the same. Right.
Yeah, pretty much. You know? Yeah.
But the way he sings it and stuff is mostly kind of like winking at some people being like, yeah, you're going to make notes when you go, but I'm following you. And yet when you listen to the album version, you're like, oh, yeah, he's basically telling you, like, I think I love you, but I can't follow you.
The one big lyric change on that is the whole bit about if you're making love to her, kiss her for the kid. That's taken out. Yeah. And that, again, that's the lines that Pete Hamill quotes on the back of the record, which, of course, didn't make it in. And it was funny. This was something I thought about at the time, and I didn't say it on the show when I did the episode with my pal Sean about When I Paint My Masterpiece. Is, of course, the back cover of Blood on the Tracks features a drawing by Bob Dylan. So yeah. Here he is talking about when he's going to paint his masterpiece, and here he is has a drawing on the back of his album that many considered the masterpiece. obviously not intentional, but I couldn't help but think of that at the time, and I don't know why I didn't say it. Shelter from the Storm. There's an alternate version I was already familiar with that was on the Jerry Maguire soundtrack.
I know. Did you buy the Jerry Maguire soundtrack because of that? Because I did.
You bet your ass I did. Yeah. Oh, yeah. When I saw that movie in the theater.
I know. I was like, what is that?
I mean, back then, even as late as 96, Bob Dylan songs weren't showing up on movie soundtracks that much. And so the minute – I really love that movie. It hasn't aged well with me. I watched it again not that long ago, and I was like, oh, okay, this isn't as good as I remember it. But at the time, I loved it. It was important to me. And then when you got that scene at the end with Tom Cruise and Renee Zellweger and the little kid,
and the baby,
and then that strum comes up, I'm like, oh my God, I'm about to hear a Bob Dylan song. And then the fact that it's an alternate version with an extra verse, yep, was just sort of amazing. I like that. I actually kind of think that version has the edge on the one on the album, but it's like 51-49.
I think honestly, between you and I, because we're both so immersed in this stuff, I mean, I think it's just like it's new to us, right?
Yeah, I think that could always be the case, you know?
Because I mean, if I really had to like press myself, I mean, at the end of the day, there's a reason the stuff grabbed you initially. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so I was the same way. For years I would like be like, oh no, you haven't heard the Jerry Maguire version, it's so much superior, you know. But I
Bob Dylan snob, you know, he's like, oh, the alternate take.
Oh, totally, totally. I mean, the Minnesota versions are all right, but secretly I was like, no, the Minnesota version's superior of a lot of these songs, but I was definitely one of those guys. I lived in New York for a while, so of course, when I hung out with musicians, and they would always say to me, like, well, I just think overall the New York version of these songs are superior, and I would get really, by the way, the other great thing, let's just say this to the Dylan camp if they're listening, thank you for remastering this stuff and putting this exactly how it was without the speed ups and everything, because it sounds so good. Because I had so many crappy bootlegs over the years of this stuff, and it's nice. But I think it take two or something like that of Shelter of the Storm that was on the Jerry Maguire, and then take four is the one that's on the record. I think take four ultimately there's just something about that, the lyrics on that are better. But I'm with you. I go back and forth. It's just such... This album means so much to me, you know, mm-hmm, and I feel like I just want to live in it all the time, and I shouldn't, you know, because it's a really unhappy record. Mm-hmm. I'm very surprised that Buckets of Rain is not, I mean, there's a lot, there's obviously every take of Buckets of the Rain, Buckets of Rain. But I think ultimately he caught the right one and set the right one free. You know what I mean? That does not seem like a song that they thought too. I mean, they did different versions of it, but ultimately I think they always knew what the version they were going to go with. I don't know. I think I'm really glad this is out there, and I'm enjoying it. I'm finding things there too, little lyrical changes. God, Tangled Up in Blue. I mean, he's still writing that song, right? I mean, that's like the craziest thing to me. He's rewriting it in 74, 75, and he's writing it now. I mean, like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, I haven't gotten to Tangled Up in Blue on the show yet because it's such a huge topic, and I'm like, yeah, almost intimidated to take it on. But, I mean, yeah, he's still fiddling with that song. I mean, and then, in fact, the version, the solo version he does of it on the Real Live record is the single reason to buy that cruddy live album is that version.
Oh,
so
that is a bad
it's
album.
So, it's a bad
That's
live
a bad
album,
album.
But that version is so good. So,
it
yeah,
is.
I mean...
And the lyrics on that are so good, but yes, yes.
Yeah. Oh, I love the alternate lyrics to that. And I think I mentioned this on the episode I did on Buckets of Rain way back in like episode 12, is that when I first bought Blood on the Tracks, I bought it on cassette. And, mm-hmm, of course, cassettes have very limited space on either side, and they actually flip the final songs on each side, I guess, to fit it in properly. So the cassette version of Blood on the Tracks ends with "You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome When You Go," and Buckets of Rain ends side one, which completely,
wow,
it completely alters the record.
Yeah, that's a different record to me.
It's a different record if it ends that way, because Buckets of Rain, it ends with this kind of que sera sera kind of thing. Like, even after all this heartbreak and this invective, yeah, and all this stuff he's poured out, at the end, it's this quiet little picking, and it's a beautiful song. I mean, the tune is really beautiful, and just the sort of kind of kidding lyrics. "I ain't no monkey, but I know what I like." I mean, I love that line. And it just ends with this much more sedate kind of, yeah, end. And it said, it's, again, I like the alternate versions. Obviously, the one that Bob sings where he's like, "Oh, that I can do better." Obviously, he wasn't happy with that one. So, again, it's the one on the record I think is great. But I like these alternate versions. They all have something to recommend them.
Yeah, I think I'm going to tell you, I mean, this is I'm one of those guys too that, like, every week my favorite song on that album changes. for many, many years, "Buckets of Rain" was my... I'm sorry. I was tuning my guitar today. I was like, oh,
there's a concert breaking out at your house, Pat.
I know. I'm in an Irish folk band these days, so, you know. "Buckets of Rain" to me was the song that got me through so much stuff. I mean, honestly, right? Rob, right? There's pieces of art, I mean, that just, you know, it makes you get up in the morning in a way, you know? And you hear a song like "Buckets of Rain," and it's like, life is sad, life is a bust. And I just think that's so great.
Yeah.
And when I was in college and stuff, I would meet these poetry professors and things, and they would always say to me, "Yeah, you know, Dylan, everyone always wants to talk about, you know, Visions of Johanna." And they were like, "You know what the best lyric Dylan ever wrote was?" And I was like, "What?" "Buckets of Rain." You know, and I was like, yes. So for me, you know, it's a personal favorite. It's nice to hear all the different versions on this, but the version that was released will always be the masterpiece. Tangled Up, I mean, what can you say? There's 17,000 versions of it. I do enjoy hearing take three or whatever. I think that was pretty good. I know you did a podcast about Up to Me. Can we just talk about Up to Me for a second? I mean,
of course.
That song, I don't know. Do you think you said it should be on the album, and I don't know where it would go. That's my only issue with that.
When I make the iTunes list, when I put on my iTunes Blood on the Tracks, yeah, playlist, I slot it between "Meet Me in the Morning" and "Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts." So that side two has six songs. That's my one addition to it. Yeah.
So I think it's interesting. How many takes did he do? He only did like three or something like that, right?
I mean, think complete. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of like the kind of incomplete ones, but yeah, he worked on. Yeah. There's take one, remake two. I never know what that remake means exactly, but there's five versions. There's one from September. There's two versions from September 19th, 1974, and then there's three other versions after that. So.
Yeah, I think that's a song that he kind of knew what that song was. But the only issue I think is that it sounds very similar to
Shelter from the Storm. Yeah,
it sounds very similar to that, and it might have thrown people if you put it out at the same time. And yet, I think that might be the one song that I'm always like it. You know, maybe that could replace Shelter from the Storm. But then Shelter from the Storm has so many lines that I love that. You know,
because if he did that, then we'd be bitching that Shelter from the Storm belongs on the record.
Right, exactly.
So he can't win, no matter what. You know, us Dylan fans are a cranky bunch, you know, no matter what he does.
Oh, you're really? Like, hey, you we're kind of we kind of are, though, because who else is like this? You know what I mean? Like, right. And, you know, I again, I think you and I are both in agreement, though. I mean, it's one of those records, like, the final record is what you have to listen to first. You kind of have to really listen to Blood on the Tracks the way it came out.
Yes.
And fall in love. And if it hits you the way it hit us, it's going to mean everything to you. It's going to shape so much of your worldview. It just, you know, some people walk into, you know, the Louvre and or whatever, or they see the Sistine Chapel and that hits them. For me, that's what this album does. This is the greatest piece of art that has ever existed because it says so much about the human condition. I mean, I'm in a great relationship now. But I'm just saying that, like, mm-hmm. I have been in every one of these depths that this man is talking yep. about.
Yeah. And, oh yeah. Yeah.
So this is my favorite thing. So to get 87 tracks, I'm like, this is awesome. I could do this.
Just that number when
day.
You say it out loud is funny. 80, I know, 87 tracks.
Well, Rob, I got it on CD. You know, so I was uploading the CDs. I was getting my car and my phone. Oh, it was terrible. But at the same time, you know, it's great. It's like watching a guy paint a painting, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever. It's really cool. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's fun to find the little things. But I personally, at least, am still like, I think it's all great. And I just wouldn't change anything about it. But I am glad to find little things. And I think you and I both agree that you're going to make me lonesome with the band. I mean, there's something about that just...
It really has. I no joke. I listen to the music while I have a long commute every day. I have an hour-long commute either way to work. And so yeah. I was listening, and there was a couple of days this week where I was listening to just that version, just on repeat, just over and over. And I already know the words. It's not like it's yeah. like it's Tempest where I'm trying to like learn the words and stuff. I already know the words, but I was listening to it over and over, and it was literally making me start to like well up because it was just so beautiful. Yeah. And again, just the fact that he could take something that I already thought was perfect and do this with it and make it perfecter is just, I'm like, I don't know how he does it. And you know, you talk about, and this will probably, I've mentioned this before, and for anybody just listen to the show, I'm probably boring because again, I'm repeating myself, but yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, that you can relate to this from a time in your past, and so can I. You know, there was a point in the a little while ago where I was doing a lot of late night driving, and this was the record that was the soundtrack. This and Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love. So that'll give you an idea where my head was at the time. Yeah, right. And I was listening to it. Oh, and it was a lot of driving in the middle of the night, like literally 2 a.m, and it was lonely roads and the whole bit. And I was very sad and listening to this record. And the comparison I make, and I'll get through this as fast as I can because it sounds insane, but is the comparison I make of this record in terms of how it hit me was the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I know, like, what? Okay. The first time I ever saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I was like around 20. And I had already seen a lot of horror movies by that point. I grew up mm-hmm. on them. But I had not seen Texas Chainsaw. And so I finally saw it. I was 2021. I had a lot of horror movies under my belt. There is a moment in Texas Chainsaw Massacre where for I probably maybe 1.5 seconds, I was mm-hmm. like, is this real? Is this really happening? And then I caught myself like, oh, that's ridiculous. Of course it is. Right, this is a movie. But there was something about the intensity that Toby Hooper managed to corral for this mm-hmm. one particular scene. And the acting seemed so unvarnished and so real that it felt like, my God, did they actually just torture this woman and Toby Hooper just filmed it? And again, I caught myself. I was alone when I had that thought. Luckily, I didn't express it because if I had said it out loud, the person would have been, what are you, crazy?
I know, right?
I've had
that date myself.
Right, there you go. And I had that. I just had this sort of like smile on my face of like, damn it, Toby Hooper, you did it. You fooled me. Right. Just for even for a half second, you fooled me into thinking this was real. And so that's why I feel like that movie is like in some ways the most scariest movie of all time, because for just that moment, I forgot I was watching a movie and I felt I was watching some horrible, you know, found footage or like a snuff film or something. And so when I was listening to Blood on the Tracks, I know, obviously, that Bob Dylan did not write this for me because I was 4 when he wrote this record, obviously. But as I was listening to it over and over again and I internalized it, and it seemed to match what I was feeling so directly that I just sort of caught myself saying, boy, it feels like he really wrote this for me. And maybe he did. No, of course he didn't. What are you talking about? He has no idea you exist. But it just the fact that he was able to put that little thing in my head for even a moment tells me how effective this record is, and it just stays that way, and it stays with you even though you get out of that point and you're not, I'm not in that part of my life anymore,
right.
But nevertheless, I still can recall those feelings, and that's how powerful this thing is. So yeah, I am thrilled this set exists. I love that this stuff has been preserved for posterity, but at the same time, I am also very glad that it does not diminish the final record. The record still stands as the record. It still stands as the masterpiece that it is.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's like a love fest whenever you and I talk.
Yeah,
you know?
Basically, yeah.
We just basically agree, except for the 80s Bob Dylan. So,
right, exactly.
But you know what I mean? Like, this record, it's you have to buy Blood on the Tracks first, you know? And I have to say, I'm a little bit on a Beatles kick right now because of this reissue and everything with the White Album, but I really do hope at some point Bob says remaster some of this stuff and really make, you know, truly pop the, you know, make everything sound really good going forward for the digital age, because this is the most pristine record, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And with just some of those tracks, acoustic guitar and bass, I mean, it's just in vocal, that's all you need. You know, it's really easy to make it sound really good. It always sounded really good, but it's so great to have this sense of like, okay, even then, I mean, I will also say, for me, at least, it really truly revealed the ultimate genius, which is that there's really not that much lyrical change. I mean, all the lines that jumped out at me when I was 16 years old, I was 12 or whatever when I found this record, were there from take one, you know? I mean, that's the other thing that I think was really kind of amazing, that he kind of really had the whole thing written before he went into the studio. And so the 87 takes are just him little trying to fiddle around with little things, but you know, the real core of the message of what he was trying to say has always been there. And I think it's the greatest. I mean, from beginning to end and beginning again, I think Buckets of Rain into Tangled Up, and you know, I just think it's such a masterpiece, and it's so great to find different versions, but they'll never, for me, they'll never exceed what was there. You know, I mean, the version of Tangled Up and Blue you need to hear is the Minnesota version.
Yep.
I mean, that makes you want to get up and grab your bag and get on a Greyhound bus and go wherever, right? It makes you want to go to Delacroix. What the hell is Delacroix? You just want to go there, you know? And when you hear the New York version of it, you're like, oh, okay, this is cool, I guess, you know? But it's just, it doesn't hit you. And then when you hear those drums and the fiddle, I mean, you know, it's just, there's something about the fact that he just knew it. He had it right from day one. But yeah. And by the way, can we just say, I just watched Deliverance a few weeks ago for the first time, which is kind of funny, I guess, because Burt Reynolds had died, or you know, and I was like, you know, I don't think I've actually ever seen Deliverance. So I watched it on Amazon, and I was like, that's a really weird movie. But to find out that the guy who plays dueling banjos or whatever was the guy that led this band, it was like so wild to me that, like, do you think that Bob went into a movie theater and was like, oh man, that's really cool.
I'm gonna get that guy. I don't know. I never.
That's all I can think of.
it's weird when we read about, and we do need to wrap up, but I do. It's interesting to read about that he brought in the whole Deliverance band for the sessions, and then kind of just kept getting rid of them till basically it was just him and Tony Brown. Like, he just kept saying, "No, I don't need you anymore. I don't need you anymore. I don't need you anymore." And eventually, it was just him and Tony Brown working on most of this record. There's a quote I think about from, and this is an interview that I've quoted extensively throughout these episodes, from Jim Dickinson, where he talks about working with Dylan on Time Out of Mind, where he said he would watch Dylan rewrite the songs for Time Out of Mind as late as when they were about to record them. He was still working on them, and he said he had like a little, just a pencil, and he was rewriting things in the margins and swapping these out. And he said, anybody who thinks this is random or chance art, or it's like, it's just comes down from Mount Olympus and goes in Bob's head and comes out of his hand, does not get it. And I think box sets like this are a real service, because it shows you how hard he worked to get to the record that he wanted to get to. You think, I mean, you talk about, there's 87 tracks here. And that's not even counting whatever alternates there were cut in Minnesota that don't exist anymore. So you're probably talking at least over 100. Imagine going over these songs 100 times to find the one version that you think is the workable one. It's unbelievable. And so, this is an amazing set. They're going to have a lot to follow up on after whatever the next set is. And so that leads me perfectly into how I want to wrap up the show. Because I'm going to ask you, Pat, And I, right. if you don't have an answer yet, I can go first. But what album left in the Dylan canon do you think do you a deserves or you just want? Forget about deserves. Want a this level exhaustive set on? Like you want the complete sessions of blank?
Yeah.
What record would that be?
Today, it's got. Honestly, today it's Street Legal. I don't know. I don't know that there's a lot there, but it would be Street Legal would probably be my first kind of go to. I think there's probably a different cuts, and I think that's a record where he would change a lot of lyrics on some of those songs, and I would like to hear what he was thinking when he was doing that. And then I don't know. You know, I mean, this isn't to knock newer Dylan fans, but I don't know that like Time Out of Mind too. I'd like to hear like the other version of Highlands or something. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But those might be my two.
Okay.
What about you?
Well, this is a very boring show because I have the same answer. It's going to be Street Legal.
Yeah!
I think that record. I think that's a really criminally underrated record, I think the songs there are genius, and I think that. I would like to hear these alter. Now, whether we – I fact, you just mentioned this on the Twitter account, pod_Dylan, and people are like, well, is there enough Street Legal outtakes to make a box set? Well, I didn't know there were 87 takes of Blood on the Tracks. So who knows what's out there? I mean, I don't know. So my number one answer is Street Legal. My B answer is, and I've mentioned this again on previous episodes, is Shot of Love because, of course, he recorded like 24 songs – that eventually none of them ever made it onto Shot of Love. I have a bootleg, in case anybody from Dylan's camp is listening. I don't have a bootleg. But I have a bootleg of like of all these songs. And these are all like Dylan originals that he just let go. And the bootleg I have is terrible. The sound is awful. You can barely make out the words. Although, of course, that's Bob Dylan. Sometimes you can't make out the words, even if the sound is great. But
sure.
But I would like to hear that. But my number one choice would be, now that they've really covered Highway 61 and they've covered Self-Portrait of all things, it would really be Street Legal. I would say I really want to hear the deluxe Street Legal, if such a thing exists. But you know what? I am so thrilled that this bootleg series exists.
Oh, yeah.
Every year that they come out with these things, it is a total treat. And so I am just utterly grateful that we get this. And this is so rewarding because there's a lot of great stuff here, but that version of You're Gonna Make Me Lonesome, I will take that with me to my grave. I think it's one of the great additions to his canon. So it was, even if I had bought the deluxe version that was like $179.99 or whatever crazy thing they're asking for it, just to get that song, I'm like, it's still worth it because this song is this is going to go with me for the rest of my life, this particular version. So thank you, Sony Music. Thank you for Columbia Records. And thank you, Bob, for doing this, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, and thanks for the red notebook, Bob, so that we can all sit around
The red notebook.
Yeah, I guess I'll never be as good as you.
Well, was that really a worry that was going to happen, Pat?
I know,
you're
going
to be as good?
So, yeah, well, you know, you want to see the crossouts and be like, see, I would have put that line there. You're never going to equal him. You know, he's so unique. Yeah.
So, well, all right, we're going to wrap it up here. We've been talking for over an hour. We could go even longer, but you know, hey, we got to stop at some point. So, Pat, you know, this again, I've said this on many episodes. One of the great benefits of doing this show, because I mean, look, I can't speak to the music, the musicianship very much of these songs because I don't know that side of it. And I am in the Dylan analyzing business. I am a very, 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 very tiny fish in a very, very, very huge pond. But luckily, the show has gotten me to become friends with a lot of great people, and I've gotten to meet, at least over Skype, a lot of really interesting people and get to meet my fellow Bobcats, which has just been great. So, and this has just been terrific. You and I have been friends now for a bunch of years, and we check back in every so often, and it's just been terrific. So thank you so much for coming back on. And I was looking so forward to this. So this was great.
You're going to make me lonesome. Thank you, Rob. I man, this is so great. This is our favorite album. It's so great to have this, right? And it's so great to talk to you about it. So thank you for having me.
All right, awesome. As always, and again, we'll do Tattle of the Day, man. We'll mark that down.
I'm marking it down.
All right, absolutely. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. If you want to listen to back episodes of the show, go to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. And of course, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes and on Stitcher and a bunch of other great podcatchers of your choice. And we're always talking Bob Dylan over on Twitter, which is at @pod_Dylan. So thanks everybody for listening. Until the next episode. So we will see you later. Bye.
I've seen love go by my door. It's never been this close before. Never seemed so easy or so slow. Been shooting in the dark too long. When something's not right, it must be wrong. You're gonna make me lonesome when you go. Back in clouds so high above, I've only known callous love. And it always has hit me from below. Round, it's more correct, right on target, so direct. You're gonna make me loads when you go. Purple clover, queen and lace, crimson hair across your face. You could make me cry if you don't know. Spoiling me too much love. You're gonna make me love when you go.